Next month marks 50 years since the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. All month long, the Alabama Public Radio News team has been examining Dr. King's work and his impact here in Alabama. King's civil rights crusade began with the Montgomery bus boycott in 1955, and it almost ended violently in March of 1968. APR's Pat Duggins visits the city of Greensboro, where a little-known standoff took place just days before King was killed.
Students from Hale County High School are heading into a small shotgun-style house. This home sits on a dirt road off of Main Street in the town of Greensboro, about an hour south of Tuscaloosa.
You all live in Greensboro?
Yes, ma'am.
How many have been to the Safe House Museum before? Only two?
Three.
Oh, three. What happened to the house?
It's a museum now. But back in the late 1960s, it was a safe house for civil rights activists, including Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. The relationship between King, the safe house, and its owner didn't get off on the right foot.
He was not impressive at all. Not from what I expected, you know.
Teresa Burroughs is 88 years old. Her home sits next door to the Safe House Museum. She owns both. Burroughs says Martin Luther King Jr. just wasn't the kind of man she thought one of her best friends would marry.
I just imagine her with maybe a football player, about six something, you know. But Martin was not like that.
The friend Burroughs thought would marry a football player was named Coretta Scott. The future Mrs. King was born in the town of Marion, about a half hour east of Greensboro. As young ladies, Burroughs and Scott would talk about boys and about the future. Burroughs says there was someone her friend said she wanted to grow up to be like.
Marian Anderson now sings Costa Diva.
She had a beautiful voice. Because she always told me, she said, I'm going to be another Marian Anderson, and I'm going to tour the world, you know, and sing. And she said, now you're going to read about me, because I'm going to be a star. You know, this is what she was talking about. And I said, that's all right. She gave up her dream and took on his.
Burroughs' impression of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. got better, though, once he did what many people say he did best.
The fact is that freedom is never voluntarily given by the oppressor.
The spirit seemed to enter his body, and it comes out through his voice. And it's just something in it that moves a person. After we got to know each other better, he was all right.
I can remember just a few years ago, right here in this city, that hospital workers made wages so inadequately that it was a shame to say to anybody these people were being paid.
King gave this speech before union healthcare workers in New England in March of 1968. It wasn't the only talk he gave that month. 10 days later, he was in Utah, Alabama, urging supporters to elect black candidates to Congress. Burroughs says after his talk, King headed straight to Greensboro to stay in the safe house.
It was a terrible night. It was an awful night.
The reason was because the Ku Klux Klan heard King was in Alabama. An armed group of Klansmen spent the night looking for him in Greensboro.
They would drive slowly by, and you could see them inside the cars, and you could see the barrels of their guns. They had the lights on the inside of the cars, and they had the lights off on the outside. They knew that he was in here. So we kept him safe.
First, news from the nation and the world from NBC Radio.
Dr. King left the next morning. For Teresa Burroughs and King's supporters in Greensboro, the feeling of victory lasted just 2 weeks.
NBC Radio News on the Hour, brought to you by Digel. Now here is Lou Wood.
The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., father of the nonviolent movement in the American civil rights struggle, was killed by an assassin's bullet tonight in Memphis, Tennessee.
It seemed that I was weak in the knees. My knees and everything was weak, and I just had to sit down. I just couldn't stand anymore.
Authorities said they had no other definite leads as to the identity of the assassin. The mayor of Memphis declared a state of emergency and reimposed a curfew on the city.
Right.
We
together,
overcome.
Okay?
We have overcome. We have overcome.
Teresa Burroughs says that's why she made the safe house into a museum. She wants people like these students on their high school field trip to remember what happened here 50 years ago, long after she's gone. Pat Duggins, APR News, in Greensboro.
We have overcome today.
Very good, very good. Okay, we want to say.
All month long on Alabama Public Radio, we've been looking at the 50th anniversary of the death of civil rights leader Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. APR's Stan Ingold spoke with a photographer who followed Dr. King and covered his funeral.
I'd like somebody to mention that day that Martin Luther King Jr. tried to give his life serving us.
It's not everyone who gets to deliver their own eulogy.
I'd like for somebody to say that day that Martin Luther King Jr. tried to love somebody.
Mourners heard from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. during his own funeral. It was a recording of a sermon at Ebenezer Baptist Church in February of 1968. It was called The Drum Major Instinct.
I'm just taking pictures left and right. Oh, there's Sammy Davis Jr. Oh, there's Jacqueline Kennedy.
Jim Pepler was a photographer for the Southern Courier newspaper out of Montgomery.
One of the shots, I remember catching Richard Nixon, right, walking through the crowd. Next to Wilt Chamberlain. Odd couple, so to speak. And then Bobby Kennedy and Ethel, and of course, he was killed later that same year.
I want to have the fine and luxurious things of life to leave behind, but I just want to leave a committed life behind. That's all.
Pepler was aware of Dr. King long before he signed on to shoot for the Courier and act as the paper's photo editor. He had heard King speak when he was finishing up in college, and it was that message that brought Pepler to the South.
There are people that have a charisma that speaks to something in those around them when they're in that presence. It spoke to me.
I've heard the thunder roar. I've felt sin breakers dashing, trying to conquer my soul. But I heard the voice of Jesus saying, still to fight on.
Pepler says King's presence was even more powerful in person.
There was a sense that he was speaking to me and everyone else in the room from his heart. He had a brilliant way of expressing deep emotional and intellectual truths and words that captured the full intention of what he meant to say with them.
Yes, this march we are continuing, started by James Meredith, I am convinced will have as great an impact, or probably a greater impact, than the march from Selma to Montgomery.
Pepler followed King throughout Alabama, but it was during a demonstration in Mississippi that he felt he got to see a different side of the civil rights leader. That demonstration became known as the March Against Fear.
I got to see him, you know, having breakfast and walking around and talking and walking along with him for hours on end on the march, being there right next to him or behind him while he was confronting state troopers as one issue or another would come up.
Pepler says seeing King on television was one thing, but seeing him work in person was a different story.
It filled out the image of what he was about and what his movement was about beyond the words and the rhetoric of his marvelous speeches, which I had had experienced up until then.
I have some very sad news for all of you, and that is that Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis.
Pepler was on an assignment when he heard that Martin Luther King Jr. had been assassinated.
I was coming back from something, I've forgotten what, in Selma, riding with a reporter. And we were driving along and heard it on the radio. And we pulled over and just started crying.
Once he put together a tribute for the paper, Pepler made his way to Atlanta to cover King's funeral, which featured singer Mahalia Jackson. Pepler says he wanted to stop and pay his respects to King at the church.
But the line at 3 o'clock in the morning went for way further than if I had gotten in that line. I may or may not have gotten the picture, but I wouldn't have gotten another picture for the rest of the day.
Lord, hold my hand and don't let me fall.
After I covered Dr. King's funeral, I had kind of lost something in myself that empowered me to carry on, and I didn't know what I was going to do. Essentially, from my point of view, King's funeral was the last thing that I was felt myself committed to getting done.
And it's at the Alabama Archives that Pepler hopes his photographic record of Dr. King will live. He donated his images from his work in the South to the Alabama Department of Archives and History, where digital copies are publicly available. I'm Stan Ingold, APR News in Tuscaloosa.
Next month marks 50 years since the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Throughout March, the APR News team is reporting on King's work and impact here in Alabama. The event is being remembered in the United States, but not just in the U.S. Alabama Public Radio participated in a visiting international journalist program last year with the West African nation of Mali. That's where the APR News team met Usman Sagara. His home country has its own relationship with Dr. King. We invited Sagara to file this report from Mali's capital city. The story begins with King's reaction to his visit to the West African nation of Ghana.
The road to freedom is a difficult, hard road. It always makes for temporary setbacks.
This is part of the sermon Dr. Martin Luther King gave in Montgomery in 1957.
Those people who tell you today that there's more tension in Montgomery than there's ever been are telling you right.
The sermon was called The Birth of the New Nation.
You can interpret Ghana any kind of way you want to, but Ghana tells me that the forces of the universe are on the side of justice.
The inspiration wasn't what was happening in the United States, but rather the African nation in Ghana. He had just returned from celebrations after Ghana declared independence from Great Britain. King looked at the fight for freedom in Africa, and he saw a reflection of what was going on in the United States.
And a new order is coming into being, an old order of colonialism, of segregation, of discrimination is passing away now. Somehow the forces of justice stand on the side of the universe.
My home country is Mali. Ghana is on our southern border. But we remember Dr. Martin Luther King too. In Mali, we have living tributes to King.
We have an English club, you know, in Mali here, which name is Martin Luther King.
Mohamed Koita is the chairperson of Martin Luther King's club.
There we learned his idea and also the mission that he did. So now we can say thanks to him now, the colored people, you know, in the United States are living better. It's like a prophecy. It's exactly happened as he said today.
Martin Luther King is one of the great leaders of the civil rights movement.
Mariam Kone is a human rights worker in Mali. She draws inspiration from how Dr. King fought for civil rights in the United States.
It really starts with the matter of the revolution to fight against the segregation, the racism, which was the way of living in the United States.
But I think it's important for these students, especially as they walk around the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute, to connect their legacy with what they see.
That's why during my time in Alabama, I wanted to visit the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute. I took part in the visiting journalist program, which is how I came to work in the newsroom at Alabama Public Radio. That led me to the institute in the city of Birmingham.
People were lynched, not just young black men, young black women as well, young black pregnant women as well.
I was shocked of the living conditions of black people.
Thank you so much for listening. Take your time as you go out, okay? Thank you.
But when I met white and black peoples, I was relieved because that explained that all of them would like to learn from this place in order to live together peacefully forever.
We must not allow our creative protest to degenerate into physical violence. Gain and again, we must rise.
And as the world prepares to remember Dr. King's assassination, one might wonder what his legacy might be in the future. I asked people on the street of Mali what they thought.
If Martin Luther King were alive today, what would you say to him?
What I will say to him is to educate more the young African leaders and also to give them the ideology during the civil rights movement.
If Martin Luther King were alive today, what would you say to him?
I would just do my best to learn as much from him.
If Martin Luther King were alive today, what would you say to him?
I would say, wow, the dream he said he has became a reality, and I hope he could be here to see that.
I'm Usman Sagara, APR News in Mali, West Africa.
Next week marks the 50th anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination. All month long, the Alabama Public Radio news team has been examining Dr. King's work and his impact here in Alabama. You heard a photographer from Montgomery recall documenting Dr. King's work. APR guest reporter Usman Sagara shared how people in the West African nation of Mali remember Dr. King. You also heard about the house where King hid from white supremacists just days before his assassination. Now, APR's Alex Aubuchon reports on another place in Alabama connected to Dr. King and how his influence is being felt by a new generation.
It was a day I never forget.
We met Teresa Burroughs earlier in our series.
I will never, ever forget that day and the beating that I took that day.
Burroughs owns the Civil Rights Safe House, where King hid from armed Klansmen in March of 1968. That wasn't her first brush with the civil rights movement.
It'd be detrimental to your safety to continue this march, and I'm saying that this is an unlawful assembly.
On March 7th, 1965, Burroughs and around 600 more civil rights activists, most of them black, marched from Brown Chapel in Selma, hoping to reach Montgomery. They wanted to protest measures aimed at preventing African Americans from voting. They were met on the Edmund Pettus Bridge by police batons and tear gas.
Go home or go to your church. This march will not continue.
You know, we were just knocked everywhere. They just beat the hell out of us.
That day became known as Bloody Sunday, and every year civil rights advocates gather in Selma to retrace those marchers' steps across the Edmund Pettus Bridge and remember their sacrifice. The bridge is often the focal point of Bloody Sunday, but just a mile and a half away, there's another monument to the fight for voting rights.
This is the house that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. lived as he planned the Selma to Montgomery March.
The house is Juwanna Jackson's family home, which has remained virtually unchanged since the mid-1960s. For a few months, it essentially became the headquarters for the civil rights movement.
And of course, our lives changed drastically from a house that had a mother and a father and a little girl. Almost overnight became a house where the world came in.
Juwanna was about 5 at the time.
And I wish I had been just a little older to understand the gravity, to understand the historical significance. To the world, he was Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. To me, he was Uncle Martin.
Juana runs the Jackson House as a museum and foundation, and it's filled with artifacts from the era.
Of the beds in this house, of course, Uncle Martin slept in every one. And over the years, my mother, for practical purposes, bought new mattresses and box springs. But this is the original mattress and box spring that was on the bed when he was here.
Photos of King and countless other historical figures fill the walls of the Jackson House.
This is the room in which Dr. King and his lieutenants booted up the morning of the 2nd March.
The bill that I am presenting to you will be known as a civil rights bill.
And then there's the spot where King saw all this effort pay off.
Because all Americans just must have the right to vote. And we are going to give them that right.
The museum contains the very chair, the very television that Dr. King was sitting in the night that President Johnson announced that he would indeed sign the Voting Rights Act, which he did several months later in August of 1965.
You heard so much about the march, but not what went on behind the scenes.
That's Alicia George. She's part of a group of students from Trinity Washington University that toured the Jackson House.
In a country that's supposed to be the home of the free, people are still not free.
George is African-American and came to the U.S. from the Caribbean as a child. She's a DACA recipient, and she says there are parallels between the 1960s and today's debates over immigration.
They weren't free back then because of the color of their skin, and now they're not free because somebody else made a decision that they didn't make, and they're being punished for it. And I believe that just as Dr. Martin Luther King and the others stood up for the rights of African Americans to be able to vote and be a people, that God's going to raise up somebody to stand up for these young people, that they too can be free to live in this country that's supposed to be the home of the free.
Teresa Burroughs says she hates to see young people of color taking their right to vote for granted, especially considering what she and others went through.
Somebody cried for them, and somebody died for them and didn't even know their name, and yet they won't go and vote.
Burroughs may have reason to be concerned. Attendance for this year's Bridge Crossing Jubilee was down sharply compared to 2015. That was the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, which drew huge crowds. However, young people like Alisa George seem to be recognizing Burroughs' sacrifice, and her call to action may be getting through. I'm Alex Aubuchon, Alabama Public Radio News in Selma, Alabama.
Next month marks 50 years since the death of civil rights leader Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. All month long, the APR News team is looking at King's work and impact here in Alabama. Each year, America honors King on the third Monday in January. The nation takes a day off work and school to remember his accomplishments. Alabama is one of only two states that also celebrates another man on the same day as Dr. King. APR student reporter Allison Mollekamp explains their legacies are very different.
He asked the question, why do we celebrate Robert E. Lee's birthday?
That's Carl Jones. He's speaking at the Sons of Confederate Veterans Robert E. Lee celebration.
Well, if Lee's birthday is not worthy of celebration, apart from Jesus Christ, I don't know whose is.
Jones and his supporters all gathered in the auditorium at the State Archives building in Montgomery. Men in gray Confederate uniforms sit side by side with men in motorcycle jackets and women dressed in their Sunday best. The mood moves between celebration and the sense that a grand cause is under attack.
It really has been a tough year for us, hasn't it?
That's Pat Godwin of the United Daughters of the Confederacy.
But actually not just this year. It all began on the 17th of June, 2015. When in Charleston, South Carolina, Dylan Roof started this avalanche of cultural genocide.
Dylan Roof is the South Carolina man who became the first person sentenced to death for committing federal hate crimes. He shot 9 black churchgoers to death in 2015. The genocide Godwin is referring to is against all things Southern.
In 1861, they allowed us to fight with bullets.
This is Pat McMurray. He's a member of the Sons of Confederate Veterans Mechanized Cavalry.
They won't let us do that today. So far, that day could come, it may not ever come. But today we're being fought against with weapons that are far more long-reaching and powerful than a bullet.
The idea of an ongoing battle is shared by a very different group of people that met a few days earlier just blocks away. The Dexter Avenue King Memorial Baptist Church sits one block from the state capitol, and the sanctuary is filled to standing room only. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. served as pastor here from the mid to late 1950s. There are women in church hats and others in shirts emblazoned with King's picture or quotes from his speeches. One notable difference between this event and the one for Robert E. Lee is the diversity. This crowd looks like what King would have wanted, black and white people sitting together. The main event of the day was the current pastor of what was once King's church, the Reverend Cromwell Handy.
I stand here today to remind us here that 50, 60 years ago, there was one who led foot soldiers who are even in this room today in order to build a bridge, not only across a bridge, but to build a bridge for those who come after.
There's a sense of a fight here, too, though Reverend Handy was careful to never name names whose congregation might be fighting against. It's easy to figure out, though, with this story about the newly married Martin Luther King, Jr.
When he married his wife, Coretta, the newlyweds were rejected by a white-only hotel. So the couple opt to spend their wedding night at a black-owned funeral home. Look away.
The Sons of Confederate Veterans event wasn't explicitly about race or slavery. But let's go back to that moment where Pat Godwin mentioned Dylann Roof. She called the after effects of his actions a cultural genocide. She and her compatriots mourn the loss of flags and monuments. What she made no mention of was the 9 black people that Dylann Roof murdered. The Lee event wasn't about race, but the crowd was very conspicuously white, save for 3 or 4 exceptions. Alabama celebrates Martin Luther King and Robert E. Lee on the same day every year, despite the fact that we are one of only 2 states left that do so. There have been efforts to change this, to either do away with Robert E. Lee Day or move it to another part of the year. For now, though, the dual holidays serve to demonstrate the reality of life in Alabama. We are still divided. The Sons of Confederate Veterans and the congregation at the Dexter Avenue King Memorial Baptist Church look back at different pasts, and they dream of different futures. There was one last thing that separated the two events. The average age of the Sons of Confederate Veterans is 56. On Dexter Avenue, elders who marched with King stood to hold hands with a crowd that included plenty of young people, including children who before last year had never known a white president. For APR News, I'm Allison Mollenkamp in Montgomery.